It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll explore the unique ecology of the Cedarburg Bog.
First, Governor Scott Walker introduced a suite of bills earlier this month to help make college more affordable for students and their families in Wisconsin.
On Thursday, the legislature's Higher Education Committee met, and officials with UW and the technical college systems voiced their support for the package of bills. State Democrats, though, called them window dressing. They say the bills don't go far enough in addressing student loan debt.
One of those bills would set aside $450,000 to fund emergency grants at technical colleges and the UW system's two-year campuses. Nico Savage just wrote a piece about this bill, and he joins us now. He's a higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Nico, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what exactly would this emergency fund bill do?
Sure. So emergency grants are grants of a fairly small amount of money, usually just a few hundred dollars, that colleges and universities are able to give to students when they face unexpected expenses. So think of something like a car repair bill or a medical bill or something like that, something that for, you know, maybe someone who's out of school, that means dipping into a rainy day fund or scrimping and saving for a couple months. For a college student who doesn't have that money set aside, it can actually be a pretty disruptive thing. You'll hear from technical college folks who say that, you know, commuter students who rely on a car to get to campus, if they have just a few hundred dollars that they need for a car repair, that can actually, you know, get to the point where students have to drop out because they can't afford to get to school. So schools are able to kind of give this money to students, kind of see them through that small expense, and they hope continue on their path toward a degree.
Now, it sounds like if this bill were to pass, it would be unique in that the money would come from the state. Tell us about that.
Right. So for most of these projects, and they exist at places like Madison Area Technical College and 9 other technical colleges around Wisconsin, the money for that comes from grant programs that are administered at kind of a national or regional level, or they come from philanthropy from various donors who make donations. A couple of experts who kind of have examined this topic say that, you know, there's about 100 of these programs around the country, and none of them that they knew of existed with state funding.
Now, Republican Representative David Murphy is the author of this particular bill. What has he said about why it's needed?
So he said it's essentially needed as a way to keep people on track. You know, when they do face those unexpected expenses, he says that it's the sort of thing that can result in someone falling behind in school, potentially dropping out in school, and then, you know, not being able to get that degree, and then making it very hard for them to make money and pay back any debts or loans or anything that they might have had from school. So he basically says this is a way that we can get people through a tough time in their education and make sure that we're not losing these students who, you know, it's going towards students who might be going to UW colleges or to the technical college system, who he says are often there on a shoestring budget as it is.
Now, this bill would create grants that are, as we said, similar to those that already exist at Madison Area Technical College. So how would this be different from that?
So there would be some different rules for these grants. Among the rules for the state program are that, for instance, the student can only use the program twice in a given academic year, and they can't receive more than a combined total of $500. The MATC program doesn't have any delineated limits, but, in function, it serves to give students about that same amount of money. It would just sort of provide a way to expand and sort of build upon what several colleges already have going.
We're talking with Nico Savage right now, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's joining us to talk about a bill that would use state funding for emergency grants for students at technical colleges and UW System's two-year campuses. And as of now, this would not go toward the four-year universities in the state. Is that something that might be on the docket down the road?
Right, and talking with Dave Murphy, he said he wanted to start it with those colleges where, like I said, students are already on tight budgets quite often, and where the need tends to be greater. At four-year colleges, he said that's something that could happen in the future, but right now he's kind of considering this a pilot program to look at how it works in the 2 years and see if they want to expand that on to the 4 years. I'll note that UW-Madison, while it doesn't have an emergency grant program, it will make no-interest emergency loans that kind of work fairly similarly available to students as well.
And for this article, you spoke with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's a UW-Madison professor who is an expert in higher education policy, and she's often a critic of Republican measures. What does she have to say about this particular bill?
Sure. So she says, yeah, and you're right, a frequent critic of Governor Walker's, kind of drew some controversy back in the summer for some tweets about the governor. But what she says is, you know, at the end of the day, this is better than nothing. She takes issue with you know, Democrats who are opposed to them. What she says is, you know, from her perspective as a researcher who wants to see students get as much aid as possible, you know, this is not everything. It's not going to, in and of itself, you know, stem the problem of college becoming more and more expensive and potentially out of reach for some students and families. But she says it's progress, and you know, from her perspective, she says, "I'll take it."
Now, is there any data out there about students who have benefited from these grants? Maybe has it increased graduation rates, for instance?
Sure. So there is some data. It's fairly limited because if you think about it, it's hard to have kind of a control group, right, of students who don't receive those grants. There's some ethical issues that get into that. But Great Lakes Higher Education Guarantee Corporation, which manages a regional program, found that students who received these grants were retained, stayed in school or graduated at a slightly higher rate than low-income students as a whole. So about 73% of students who receive emergency grants stayed in school compared to 67% of Pell recipients as a whole, Pell Grant recipients, I should say.
And what are critics saying about this bill?
Well, one of the big issues is as I mentioned earlier, essentially that, you know, a few hundred dollars when you compare to, you know, several thousands of dollars that people might be spending on college costs, they'll say, you know, that's not a whole lot. It's certainly true, and I think Representative Murphy and others have acknowledged that this is, you know, this bill and this help is not aimed at you know, entirely solving the problem of college being expensive. In fact, one of the stipulations for the bill is that this funding can't be used to pay for things like tuition or books or that sort of thing. It's more for those unexpected emergency expenses. So that's certainly a criticism that we've seen come up, that, you know, a few hundred dollars in the long run is not going to do everything. But what supporters of it point out is that in the right moment, those few hundred dollars can certainly go a long way.
What do we know about what's next for this particular bill and the suite of bills in general?
Right. So the six bills that make up the Republican College Affordability Package are going to be coming up for a vote Thursday morning in the Assembly Committee on Colleges and Universities, which Representative Dave Murphy chairs. But as for what's going to come after that, there is some question, because given the lower-than-expected budget estimates, we've already heard some talk from leadership or from those in the legislature that the extra spending in these bills, even though it's comparatively small, might be something that won't be possible given that new budget outlook.
Nico, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Nico Savage, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us there to talk about a bill that would use state funding for emergency grants for students at technical colleges and UW System's two-year campuses.
European settlers to Wisconsin saw wetlands as wasted space to be drained. But 63 years ago, Wisconsin's DNR preserved an intact wetland in Ozaukee County by designating it the second Wisconsin State Natural Area. Nancy Camden walked a trail with a member of the Friends of the Cedarburg Bog.
This is Highway 33. We're about halfway between West Bend and Saukville. My name is Kate Redmond, and I am an environmental educator. I have been a volunteer for close to three decades now. I lead a lot of field trips trying to introduce people to this wetland. We're getting farther from the highway now, and we've gotten into an area where the trail is packed down gravel and dirt, and there are wetlands on each side. It's a fantastic place to come and take pictures in the spring as things start to green up. Watts Lake is at the end of this trail. The name says Cedarburg Bog, but you don't need any special foot gear to get in here. And it's not a bog, and it's not in Cedarburg. The bog part is appropriate because there are some bog plants common to a bog and a fen, which is what we really are, is a fen. A true bog doesn't have any outlets. And in a fen, there is water flow through the system. This particular fen does not have very many nutrients. So it's a challenge growing in the middle of the bog, and some of the plants like pitcher plants and sundews and the blueberries are adapted to accept that challenge. We're standing in front of a disc of roots that was exposed when the tree tipped over, and that's the really amazing story about this place. Everything that happens in here, all the tree growth and the plant growth, happens in the first foot of soil, and the soil is a real mucky, peaty kind of soil. It's very organic and it smells fantastic. All the trees that are in here have these interlocking roots that go out, and they all kind of keep each other standing. The DNR owns 1,733 acres in the bog, and UWM owns 230 acres. It's also a national natural landmark. It was the second state natural area that was declared in 1952. Its management plan includes hunting and fishing, although most smart hunters stay within 100 yards of the edges, because once you're any farther in than that, the going is pretty tricky, and there's a lot of poison sumac growing on hummocks, so you don't want to grab hold of any piece of vegetation that you see. Along this trail, there's not a lot of poison sumac. Wetlands have values as far as floodwater control and water purification, as well as being good places for wildfowl and other wildlife. We had a pretty credible wolf sighting here a few years ago, and I was out in the middle of the string bog one time and heard a bobcat on the other side of one of the strings from me, which was really exciting. And we have a lot of coyotes. There are certain times of the year when they're more vocal than other times. This is a dynamite place for dragonflies, and I've seen some species of dragonflies here that I have not seen in other places. Hard to leave.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to tell us more about the Cedarburg Bog is Jim Reinarts, director of the UW-Milwaukee Field Station. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for being interested in the bog.
Yeah, well, tell us some more about what makes the Cedarburg Bog a unique ecological specimen.
I guess one of the main things is just its relatively pristine condition. No one ever really figured out how to drain the Cedarburg Bog or alter it much, and I think a lot of that is because of its size and setting in the landscape. If you picture a lake that's 3.5 miles from north to south and 3/4 mile to 2 miles across, and then picture that lake all filled in with muck and peat, except for 6 much smaller lakes. And then picture that lake with 7 or 8 different islands that stick up out of the lake, and you've got a pretty good picture of the Cedarburg Bog.
We've had a sea change, or a swamp change, if you will, in the way we think of wetlands, haven't we? It used to be something that was that needed to be drained so that we can do something productive with it. That's not the way we think about them anymore, is it?
No, well, sometimes we still do, I'm afraid, but not a wetland like this that's such a jewel in terms of the biodiversity that it supports. There are so many plant and animal species that depend on wetlands like the Cedarburg Bog, and the Cedarburg Bog probably would have been drained for muck farming had that been possible, but it wasn't.
Well, let's talk about the tamarack tree. I understand this is a key element of this kind of wetland and part of what defines it. Tell us more about the tree and the role it plays in this ecosystem.
Well, there are a couple main trees, both of which are... If someone's trying to picture the Cedarburg Bog, they should picture the wetlands they've seen in low areas in northern Wisconsin, because two of the main trees are conifers. The tamarack, which is our only deciduous conifer, it loses its leaves, loses its needles in the fall.
Huh.
And then we have white cedar, which is another real common northern conifer, and essentially the Cedarburg Bog is like a little piece of northern wetland way down here in the southeastern part of the state. So there's somewhere around 330 species of plants, not counting mosses and lichens and things like that, in the Cedarburg bog, and 10% of them, 33 of them, are at or very near the southern edge of their range in the Cedarburg bog.
Talking to Jim Reinerts, director of the UW-Milwaukee Field Station, taking a visit to the Cedarburg bog. Now, Jim, I understand it's not, this is getting to a fine point from here, it's not a bog, it's technically a fen, is that right? And if so, what's the difference?
Well, there, because it's so big, and there's one outlet stream down at the southwest corner, and groundwater leaks in on the north and the west side. That water flows down through the wetland, and because of its size and the islands and the complexity of that water flow, there's 12 or 13 different, distinctly different wetland plant communities that grow in the Cedarburg bog. So most of the major wetland plant communities that occur in the state of Wisconsin can be found in the bog. There is one really relatively small area that you would call a bog, an open bog. And the difference is a bog, at least in this part of the state, really would receive no input of water other than direct rainfall. As soon as groundwater comes in and has an influence, it keeps the pH of the wetland neutral or even alkaline and prevents real bog conditions from developing. But there's one little lobe of the Cedarburg bog that has black spruce, which is an indicator of kind of bog conditions, and a little area with sphagnum hummocks with leatherleaf and bog rosemary and pitcher plants and all those really cool northern plants.
So I've been thinking of this as an ecosystem. It sounds like it's a group of ecosystems all clustered together.
Well, it's certainly a whole group of plant communities, yes. It's one big wetland system. Hydrologically, it's one big complicated wetland with water flowing through it and draining out one corner, but in terms of the plant communities, you can be in different parts of the bog, and there's very little similarity from one place to another.
I feel like I can sort of picture what this would look like in the summer. I haven't been there myself, but what does it look like now, late January? What's going on in the Cedarburg bog?
Well, now's the time of year that it's easy to walk in the bog. Yeah. And in fact, at this coming Sunday, the field station and our friends group, the Friends of Cedarburg Bog, are having a big winter hike where we hike all the way up through the truly wilderness areas of the bog and into some remote lakes. And if anyone listening would be interested in that, I can either Google Friends of the Cedarburg Bog or go to bogfriends.org and you can register for that event, which is really, it's really fun. It's a big, long hike.
Go ahead.
So anyway, winter is the time that it's easy to get around because the bog's frozen, and it's much easier to see. Most of the bog vegetation is pretty thick. You don't get big, long vistas unless you're on one of the lakes or in a cattail marsh kind of community. But in the winter, with good solid footing, it's just so much easier to get around. In the summer, it's rough going.
Sounds like, yeah.
Up to your knees in muck. And
plus the poison sumac.
Poison sumac, but you can get poison sumac in the winter, too.
Okay.
In fact, it's pretty virulent in the winter.
Oh, tell us, as we start to wrap up, about the condition of the bog. Are there things you're concerned about as far as conservation and preservation of this unique ecosystem?
And the biggest threat to the Cedarburg bog is, not surprisingly, an invasive species, and it's a glossy buckthorn. It's a big shrub that grows in the bog, and right now the Friends of Cedarburg Bog have a pretty major grant where we have crews out in the bog working to control glossy buckthorn in at least part of the bog. I would say that's the major threat. Other worries, I guess, would be any disruption of the groundwater, the water flow. I think road salt may be a eventually be an issue for the Cedarburg bog. So there are threats from being located in southeastern Wisconsin.
Oh, as I understand it, the Wisconsin Bird Conservations Initiative named this an important bird area. What kind of birds count on the bogs, either as a home or as a migration stop?
Oh, it's amazing. They're doing the big Wisconsin Bird Atlas inventory right now. And if you look at the atlas the last time it was done and look at the distribution of breeding birds in Wisconsin, you will repeatedly see these marks right where the Cedarburg bog is, because there's so many species that breed there. And there's, I mentioned the northern plants that grow in the Cedarburg bog. Well, there's a whole list of northern birds that don't breed any further south than the bog, including brown creeper, winter wren, Canada warbler, Nashville warbler, white-throated sparrow. There's a whole list of birds you won't find any further south than this.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for being interested.
That's Jim Reinerts. He's the director of the UW-Milwaukee Field Station. We've been talking about the Cedarburg Bog.
More than 5 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia, according to the Alzheimer's Association. And by mid-century, that number is expected to triple because of the aging of the baby boomers and signs that dementia is occurring more often in younger people.
Here in Wisconsin, our State Department of Health and Human Services estimates that about 115,000 Wisconsinites currently are living with dementia. That creates a need for a large number of caregivers who are often family members. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss created the Speaker's Task Force on Alzheimer's and Dementia in August of last year. That bipartisan group just announced that they will pursue fast-tracked approval of a package of 10 bills aimed at providing support for people living with dementia and especially for their caregivers.
Joining us right now to talk about that effort is Republican Representative Todd Novak of Dodgeville, who serves on the task force. Representative Novak, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this is a group of bills which is aimed at addressing the crisis of caring for people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. What is the scope of those bills?
The scope of the bills, there's 10 bills, actually, that came out of the committee. The task force held hearings all across the state and listened to people who, from caregivers to employers to a variety of dementia care specialists, who had their own stories to tell. And so these bills are kind of related to what we heard on the task force and kind of specific to what we felt was important and narrowed down to 10 different areas.
Well, from those listening sessions, what kind of picture emerged about the state of Alzheimer's care in Wisconsin?
I think that the what emerged to me, I think one thing that really struck me is the struggle that caregivers go through, and how important it is to give them the support they need, and also it's very important to have your county ADRCs that are well versed in dementia and Alzheimer issues. My piece of the 10 bills actually deals with the dementia care specialist. And how important they are to people. I think that's just important to have that network for people to have. And I think that's an important issue that I took out of this.
What do we know about who's caring for people with Alzheimer's and dementia right now in the state?
Well, what I'm hearing and what we heard is, you know, the caregiver is usually the loved one, the family member, and it gets to a point where, you know, the caregiver themselves are wearing out trying to take care of their loved one, because realistically, I mean, no one wants to put someone in a facility unless they absolutely have to. So caregivers are giving it their all. So we need that support network for caregivers to have, to give them a break, to give them the help they need and to the where they need to go.
So you're mentioning respite care for caregivers who might be exhausted. Is there also training that they could use to help them better care for the people in their lives who have dementia?
Yeah, there is a training available, and this is where the dementia care specialists that work with the Aging and Disability Resource Centers come in. That's what they're there for, and you know, it's in they have the knowledge and the resources to support individuals with dementia and their families, and also to, you know, to make dementia-friendly communities, to work with businesses, employers. That's the key to what dementia care specialists do, and my bill actually adds four more dementia care specialists into the mix in the rural areas.
Well, what do we know about the people who are living with dementia in Wisconsin? How many are there right now?
I'm not sure of the very specific, the exact number. I do know that the task force actually took a virtual dementia tour, which is they put you in an environment where you actually live like a person with dementia. You wear glasses and that distort, and you know, you have white noise in the background, and you're given instructions on how to do things. And it was very an eye-opening experience for everybody on the task force that took this virtual dementia tour to know what it was like to live with as someone who has Alzheimer's dementia. It was only 30 minutes the tour. And it was an experience that really struck all of us. In fact, one of the bills that is came out of the task force is to fund the virtual dementia tour to instruct the DHS, Department of Health and Human Services, to appropriate money to buy licenses for these tours, because it's just quite an experience. It gives you a whole different perspective.
Yeah, I didn't know there was such a thing as that. What else did you come away with besides the funding that these tours are valuable? How else did it change your thinking?
It just changed my thinking. You know, everybody on the task force has some connection to somebody with Alzheimer's and dementia, and that's why we were a great group, bipartisan group. And, you know, we came out of this room, and it's like, you know, some of us felt bad because we lost our patients with somebody that had Alzheimer's or dementia. But after this tour, we realized, oh, wow, you know, this is what's happening to my loved one or something. This is why they are the way they are. And it was just an eye-opening experience for all of us, and really put things in a different perspective. I can't even describe it unless you actually go through it.
We're talking right now with Todd Novak, a Republican from Dodgeville. He represents Assembly District 51, and he's joining us now to talk about a new package of bills aimed at helping caregivers for people with dementia. And in terms of the 10 bills and this group of bills, what is the plan for them? Will they be rolled out simultaneously, or are there higher priorities on the list and lower priorities?
Well, actually, it was perfect timing, because they actually have been introduced. And I was in Madison today. The Assembly Mental Health Committee heard these bills, the testimony on these bills today, and I'm fortunate enough to sit on the committee. So we're on the fast track with them. So we've already had our first committee hearing on them this morning. And I'm thinking they'll probably come out of committee maybe next week. So I would expect these bills to see the assembly floor very shortly, definitely in February, at one of the February sessions. There's a lot of support for these bills, a lot of, you know, it's bipartisan across the board.
And we have heard just recently that the budget outlook for the state is less robust than had been hoped. Do you expect that to affect these bills?
Possibly. You know, I think the total price tag on all these bills is around $2 million, which in my mind, yes, seems like a lot of money, but it isn't, because the long-range picture for me is that for $2 million, we can get a great return on investment. Not, I shouldn't say investment, but you know what I'm saying? It's actually going to save the state money in the long run. By investing $2 million in these bills and these programs that we want to do, in the long run, we'll actually save money. And I think that's important.
Representative Novak, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great to be on.
That was Todd Novak, a Republican from Dodgeville, from Assembly District 51. He joined us there to talk about a new group of bills aimed at helping caregivers for people with dementia and Alzheimer's.
Coming up, we'll continue talking about support and resources for caregivers with an aging home and family expert for AARP. We just heard about a package of bills getting bipartisan support at the Wisconsin State Capitol that would provide support for Alzheimer's caregivers. Of course, there are many people who are already caring for loved ones living with dementia, and it can be a real challenge to take care of yourself while caring for another.
Joining us now with some advice for maintaining your own physical and emotional health while acting as a caregiver is Amy Goyer. She's an aging home and family expert for AARP, and she's the author of Juggling Work and Caregiving. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, let's start off by talking about what we mean when we talk about that role of caregiver. How do you define that?
Well, it can be a really wide role, a variety of roles, but we talk in generally about people who are caring for loved ones who are friends, family, or neighbors. We know there's about 40 million family caregivers in the U.S., and we know that, you know, a large number of people are caring for people with dementia or other forms of Alzheimer's. And I myself am caring for my dad who lives with me. He's 92 and has Alzheimer's disease.
What kinds of particular challenges are you facing, Amy, and other caregivers? What kinds of challenges do they face that might be different from someone who wasn't struggling specifically with dementia or Alzheimer's?
You know, we talk about caregiving a lot of times in terms of the intensity of the experience. And the more time that you spend caring for someone, of course, the more harder it is, and it's harder to take care of ourselves. And we know that caring for someone with dementia is very intense. They tend to need more care, more constant care. I know my dad can't be alone for, you know, 5 seconds. He really needs to be one-on-one care all of the time. And that's very intensive. It's very emotionally draining to see someone that you love changing so drastically. And it's also very physically draining just to provide the care. As the disease progresses, it really is a lot of physical care as well as, you know, the mental cognitive capabilities changing so much. And it's a very long haul. That's the other piece of it. It's a long, gradual descent. And we know that, it, you know, usually at least 10 years does someone need some sort of care when they have Alzheimer's. And that's like, you know, I say it's like running a marathon and you don't know where the end is.
We just spoke with Representative Novak, who was talking about some of the bills, which included bills that would address the need for respite care. What kind of respite care would be helpful, the most helpful for people who are caregivers like you just described?
You know, getting a break is the most important thing when you are a caregiver. And respite, that's essentially what respite care is. It's a break from caregiving. And it means that someone else is taking care of your loved ones during that time. So it may be that you have someone come in and just be with your loved one so you can get out and go to a doctor's appointments. I think, you know, self-care really is the greatest need. Sometimes it's just sleep, that, you know, I can take a nap or I can sleep during the night while someone is taking care of my dad or looking out for him. We know that caregivers tend to put their own doctor's appointments at the bottom of the list as well. So many times we need respite care so that we can go out and do our own doctor's appointments or do the grocery shopping or any number of things.
And is there any kind of training that would help people who are caring for a loved one but may not have any sort of particular expertise about dementia? Is there any sort of help along those lines that could be rendered?
I always recommend that people contact the local Alzheimer's Association chapter because they tend to have good workshops and trainings and conferences. There are a lot of great videos online now as well. As caregivers, we're often isolated. It's hard to get away and go to an actual training, but we can watch some videos online, and there's everything from how to communicate with those who have Alzheimer's to providing direct hands-on care. One of the greatest things, greatest tools is music. I am trained as a music therapist myself, and I use music a lot throughout my career and with my dad now. And, you know, just some simple kind of training on how to structure the day, how to help communicate with people, the basics of and knowing what to expect is really helpful for those who are caregiving for those with Alzheimer's.
We're speaking with Amy Goyer right now, an aging home and family expert for AARP. She's also the author of Juggling Work and Caregiving. And let's talk about that work aspect of it. If someone has a family member that they're caring for with dementia, how do they hold down a job and make money?
It's tough. I work full time, and I think you put together a package of caregiving. It's sort of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. We piece it. I have some paid caregivers who take care of my dad when I'm working. He's a veteran, and he has respite care from the Veterans Affairs, and that's very helpful. We have family members who step in at different times, but we know that, 60% of caregivers work at some point while they're caregiving, so this is a really important issue. And we need to think about the fact that if caregivers can't work, how are we going to contribute that financial support for those we're caring for? So the more respite care and programs of that sort that are in place, the better we are able to juggle life, work, and caregiving.
And you mentioned the isolation that can be a part of this picture. Are there caregiver support groups that are easily accessible across Wisconsin?
Yes, there are many in-person caregiver support groups. Again, contact that Alzheimer's Association or your local area agency on aging. And you can go to www.eldercare.gov and put in your zip code and find where your local area agency on aging is. They tend to have lists of support groups. I know a lot of us, people are like me who are working and caregiving, it's hard to get to an in-person support group. So there are things online that are helpful. AARP has an online community where you can post questions and interact with other caregivers. We also have a great resource center, Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. And again, the Alzheimer's Association has online groups. Many other organizations have online support. I think social media is even very helpful. I know that being able to connect with some, there are Facebook groups. I'm in one called Memory People that I can, communicate with other people using a medium that I'm used to because I use Facebook. I just participated in a Twitter chat today. It's called Alz Chat, ALZCHAT, hashtag Alz Chat. And we're talking about communicating with people with dementia, and there are all kinds of helpful hints. So I think in this current day and age, we have to have multiple ways to get support to those who are caregiving.
I imagine that reaching out for help would be one of the biggest hurdles, or could be, for people who are caring for someone to admit that you're tired and you can't take it anymore and you need a break. How do you help people get over that initial hurdle and ask for the help that they need?
I look at it this way. I don't expect my car to run without gas, but I seem to expect myself to run without filling my own tank, and that's not reasonable. And I say taking care of ourselves is not a selfish act. It's actually very practical. I can't, if I'm not taking care of myself and getting breaks and getting the help that I need, I'm not really able to be a good caregiver. So it's a very practical thing. Many of us feel like emotionally we should be able to do this. I want to take care of my loved one. I want to be with them every minute. They're more comfortable with me, so therefore I can't, ask someone else to be taking care of them. But this is a very practical issue. And asking for help is not shameful in any way. It's actually the right thing to do.
And Amy, what can friends and family, maybe coworkers, do if they're near someone who may need help but hasn't asked for it? What could they do?
I think listening to a caregiver is really important, first of all, because sometimes they're very hesitant to share, the struggles that they're going through, especially at work, because they feel like they need to leave their personal life at home. So just encouraging them to know that you're open and that you're there for them and can hear. And then, really trying to get an idea of what's on their to-do list. AARP has an initiative right now called Random Acts of Kindness for Caregivers. And you can go online at aarp.org/caregiverkindness and just submit some of the nice things you're doing for caregivers. And there's actually a contest where there's going to be some cash prizes at the end. But the idea is to get people to do those little things. And it may be taking care of their yard or going to the grocery store for them or taking care of sitting with their loved ones so they can get a break. It may be really practical things, too, like sorting the mail. That's something that really helps me a lot. Ask them what's on their to-do list. See if you can run some errands for them.
And Amy, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And folks can actually text 97779 if they want to have some ongoing support from me and AARP. Sometimes texting is the easiest way to get out.
That was Amy Goyer, an aging home and family expert for AARP and the author of Juggling Work and Caregiving.